Republican Party endorsed Roy Moore. You cannot claim that you stand for women and put up with that. Speaking of bad guys, Marine Le Pen, her grandfather is a racist and a Nazi. She claims that she stands for him. And the fact that CPAC invited her is a disgrace. Well.
That was Mona Charon at CPAC last week. I am Catherine Mangue Ward, filling in for Matt Welsh, who is somewhere buried under a pile of old copies of the Declaration of Independence. He will be back next week. I am joined at the Reason Podcast today by Robbie Suave and Eric Boehm here in the DC office, as well as Nick Gillespie somewhere in the wilds of real America. Say hi, Nick.
I am here and everything is good.
This is, as always, the Reason Podcast. Before we get started, let me remind you to go to iTunes, subscribe, rate, review us, show us your love, show us your hate, listen and learn. Let's start out with that Mona Charon quote. She is a longtime conservative stalwart. If anybody should feel at home among 1,000 conservatives in a giant conference center, it should be her. And she is getting booed, and people in the crowd are shouting, "They're not true." Robbie and Eric were both at CPAC this week, though neither of them, I think, were there for that specific speech. Robbie, let's start with you. What did you think about the Mona Charon gate? Are we calling it that?
I don't know if we're calling it that.
We should.
We should call it that. It, to me, just made even more abundantly clear that CPAC has sort of become a kook fest. There are a lot of people there to see kind of these, you know, larger-than-life celebrity people. I saw David Clark speak, the sheriff, people like that, who have crazy things to say and don't really talk about policy and aren't all that conservative in many ways. I saw a panel discussion featuring James O'Keefe and James Damore, the Google memo guy, talking about, I don't know, how we need to regulate Twitter to make it more amenable to conservatives or something. I mean, this is the Conservative Political Action Conference for regulating private companies, I guess. So that as well just kind of shows. I mean, this is Trump's CPAC. He is the Reagan-like figure to young conservatives now, I guess, and that's a very different thing.
Mark Schlapp, who is CPAC's chairman, described Marion Le Pen. I don't know. There's so many Le Pens, all of whose names sound almost exactly right. I'm sure that if Matt were here, he would correct my accent. But the Le Pen who was there, Marion, the granddaughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen and the niece of Marine Le Pen, who is the leader of the National Front, the chairman of CPAC described her as a classical liberal. Nick, what are we supposed to do with that?
Nothing. I mean, laugh at it, I think. I think it's correct to say that CPAC has kind of jumped the shark. The conservative movement in many ways has jumped the shark because as much as they want to protest the effect of Trump, they have to acknowledge that in large measure, Trump is doing exactly what they want. Even somebody like Mona Charon, who had a very good piece in the New York Times saying, "I'm glad I got booed at CPAC," and she not only called out Le Pen, but also David Clark, the Milwaukee County Sheriff, who Robbie name checked. But, you know, the fact is that what do conservatives want at CPAC, at National Review, at a lot of places? You know, they want a strict limitation on immigration. They want a strong national defense. They want all sorts of regulations on lifestyles and other things they don't care about. And I think it's worth looking at the conservative crackup that's happening because the broadly defined Republican Party, which is a party of conservatives, is splitting basically over questions about temperament, really. Not about questions about policy. And to the extent that any of these people are defecting, they're moving into a libertarian position where we should be open, you know, we should have free trade. We should have more open borders. We should be more willing to accept more people and more ideas from around the world. So This is what happens when you, what was it, only 4 or 8 years ago that Bobby Jindal, the former governor of Louisiana, said that the Republicans have to stop being the stupid party. You know, this is what you get.
Eric, you went to maybe a corner of CPAC where there might have been more libertarians lurking. Did you have any feeling that there was still that coalition was intact in any way?
I don't know about that. I mean, I spoke to one gentleman there who was talking to and trying to encourage conservatives to appealing to their supposed conservative values and trying to pitch an agenda for legalizing marijuana under that sort of conservative umbrella. He was not even the minority, doesn't even begin to describe how, you know, small that that representation was there. I think just going back to Mona Sharon for a second, I mean, it makes sense. She says that it's disgraceful for CPAC to have invited Le Pen. I'm gonna push back against that. I think it makes a lot of sense, actually, that CPAC invited Le Pen. If there's one thing that the whole Trump ascendancy in the Republican Party and the transformation that he has sort of pushed on the Republican Party and on the conservative movement in America, it looks to me a lot like what you see from the far right parties in Europe, like the National Front in France. And so, if that's what the conservative part of the Republican Party, or really the central part of the Republican Party, is going to be, then these are the figures you're going to see. And they are, they are not classical liberals. They are noxious to anyone who holds libertarian or freedom-loving ideas. But I was there for Le Pen's speech on Thursday, and there was far more engagement from the audience, positive engagement and positive feedback from the audience during her address than there was from, say, Secretary Alexander Acosta, who's the head of the Department of Labor and is doing good things in terms of reforming. He's talking about reforming occupational licenses, good on the regulation front. I mean, this is the center of what conservatives used to care about, right? Get the government out of the workplace. Nobody really cared what he had to say. His address and his conversation was rather boring compared to Le Pen. That's where the CPAC crowd is right now, and I think that was very clear this week.
Robbie, you've been to a few CPACs in a row now. What was different at this one? And also, do you think that what happens at CPAC tells about what's happening in the Republican Party, or is it like the Iowa straw poll, where we have this sort of extremely weird little pocket that people use as a, you know, tea leaves that they are going to read with dubious accuracy?
You know, for all the differences, there is some continuity as well, though, right? I mean, I saw a lot of the same people I see every year. I sat down with them. We talked about, you know, what's going on in national politics. They're many of them who actually do have sort of limited government feelings inside of them are frankly confused right now because Trump.
Their feelings inside of them are making them confused and upset.
Yeah. Right. Well,
it's
there's some
sad day for conservatives.
See previous reason video where yes. We went on Grindr at CPAC.
That's right. There's I'm sure that there's continuity in that as well. But there is some reason to be happy, right? About I mean, we talked about this on the podcast, I think last week, that Trump, from a regulation standpoint, from a taxes standpoint, has not been sort of the apocalyptic meteor crashing into Earth that we thought he might be if he like immediately started a war with North Korea or something. That said, his temper.
Does North Korea have meteors now?
Yeah, that'll. I mean, we might find out soon enough. But it's really the civility and the sort of flashy cultural battles and the anti-immigrant rhetoric that is so horrifying, and that is either kind of ignored because, well, at least he's doing okay. But Gorsuch, but regulation, which I think is sort of a wrongful kind of smear, but then there's the crowd who really is there for the flashy cultural battles, for Sheriff David Clark, like, you know, promising to lead us into some grand new authoritarian future with Marine Le Pen or whatever her name is at his side.
The other one, Marion.
Some other kind of cartoon characters.
Nick, we've talked a lot about the Mona Sharon speech, but I think another interesting piece of it is the reception of the Mona Sharon New York Times op-ed. It's one of the most read op-eds on the New York Times this weekend. It's a story that people who are worried about conservatism in Trump's America want to hear. And so I want to hear it a little bit. I mean, I want to hear, you know, there are still conservatives who can get up and say, hey, conservatism doesn't have to look like it looks under Trump. Let me tell you my version and have people listen. I'm a little worried that this is the strange new respect phenomenon in action, though. I mean, it's New York Times readers like Mona Sharon.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, part of it is, you know, the New York Times loves nobody better than a conservative who says, you know, conservatives are awful. And I finally, either I'm becoming a liberal or I just hate other conservatives because they're not really conservative. And so, you know, they gave this treatment to people like Charles Sykes and whatnot, other kind of intra-movement conservatives who were saying, enough, you know, never Trump, or I don't like what Trump's bringing into the party. I think that there's a fundamental problem, though, and this is something that it's not up to, you know, the New York Times liberals. They can appreciate this, and it's not up to libertarians. It's up to people like Mona Sharon, who in her op-ed talks about how, oh, you know, she fell hard in her youth for Bill Buckley and National Review. When you look at the anti-immigrant rhetoric in particular, because that is the issue that defined Trump and continues to define him in many ways, whether you're talking about actual policy stuff or, you know, outlandish statements like saying most immigrants come from shithole countries or shithouse countries or, you know, shitbag countries, whatever. You know, it was National Review.
It seems like the container for the shit is very important to the people who are still litigating this Trump thing.
Yes. The important thing is that these people are shit people, right? Because that's what he meant to say. It was National Review in the 1990s using stuff from running cover story after cover story by Peter Brimelow, who eventually went on to, you know, create the white supremacist site, VDARE, which is named after supposedly the first white baby born in America. You know, they mainstream this with a series of cover stories that I remember Reason and particularly Virginia Postrel, who was editor at the time, engaging and getting hammered by conservatives. What Trump is about is, you know, to the extent that he is a bad actor, it's because he is following a lot of what National Review believed in and mainstream Republicans. You know, when we talk a lot about this at Reason, more so than you see, you know, on the right more generally, which is that, you know, the Republican Party goes soft about fiscal responsibility whenever they are in power. They are terrible almost to a person on foreign policy. They are terrible on immigration, and they tend to be very situational when it comes to things like regulation, particularly of individual stuff, but also of pharmaceuticals, also of drug legalization. I think what the Republican Party, broadly speaking, and that coalition that exists within conservatives, they need to admit that they have run out of road on conservatives, because this is what you get. Like, you can't say, oh, Donald Trump is awful because he says mean things about, immigrants or third world people or something. And it's like all you have been doing for the past 25, 30 years has been railing against immigrants. And all you've been doing is saying we need to invade more countries. We don't have to worry about deficits when we're in power. So, I think it sucks to be a conservative right now, because intellectually and I think ideologically, they don't make sense anymore.
So here's a place where I would say conservatives and libertarians still have some agreement, and it's also places at the top of the news. That was not as good of a segue as Matt would have done. Matt would have been like, speaking of Mexicans, guns, which is what's about to happen here. So obviously, gun control back in the news due to the Parkland school shooting. The front man for the sort of leading candidate for possible strange new respect that I don't think played out, Marco Rubio, getting into himself into a town hall situation and sort of signaling that he and maybe other Republicans had some willingness to move toward a small amount of gun control or some gun control measures. This is somebody who has an A-plus rating from the NRA, who's taken something like $3 million from the campaign lobby, from the NRA's lobbying arm. What do we make, Robbie, of the political response to this shooting? You've been covering it a lot on the ground from the law enforcement perspective, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But first, are the Rubios of the world the wave of the future, this sort of inarticulate, quasi-conservative defense of gun rights followed by, I'm a politician and I just want to be loved, please don't hate me?
So I really think Marco Rubio would sell out any cause other than invading every country on the face of the earth and maybe maintaining hostile relations with Cuba. Those are really, he's an interventionist, militaristic neocon Republican, and it's never struck me that he really cares about any other cause. So I was not surprised that he folded immediately on gun rights. I actually think it seems like other conservatives are certainly holding the line, because holding the line in the past has been easy because this issue always goes away rather rapidly. This time it's not going away because the activists mobilize very quickly. They're telegenic, affluent white kids, so they can stay in the news and they have this base of support. And I think the strategy of attacking them is pretty stupid and bad, or at least they've been attacked in a way that makes them look sympathetic. Like, why? How dare these kids, you know, venture to have an opinion and enter the national scene, which I think is just loathsome to say they have no right or they don't have something to say. Obviously, they do have something to say, and we should, you know, if we care about gun rights, we should argue against them, but, you know, take what they're saying seriously.
We also published a piece at Reason by Jerry Tuccilli, our like wilderness homeschooler correspondent in Arizona, who has written for us before
the peaceful Unabomber you're trying to paint.
The peaceful Unabomber. He's like the Unabomber, but a pacifist. Jerry Tuccilli. Yeah.
And he likes technology a little bit more than the Unabomber.
Yeah. So he obviously has written for us about teaching his son to shoot and hunt. And he wrote a piece, which I thought was pretty great, which essentially said teenagers don't have well-informed opinions about things. And of course, that goes on both sides. And another controversy that sprung up around the Parkland shooting is whether or not student protests should be punished, right? If we're talking about walkouts, if we're talking about, you know, kids missing school to go to rallies, you know, there have been some principals, including a principal in Texas, who have said, listen, we're not, you know, you're going to get suspended if you skip school to do this protest. Again, sort of asking this question about where kids should be in the political spectrum and how much we should honor their voices. I personally shudder at the thought of a world in which school superintendents get to decide which political causes are worthy of a skip day and which ones aren't. That does not strike me as an optimal pedagogical outcome. But Donald Trump typically likes this kind of issue, right? Like, you're right, it might not be the smartest thing to say, shut up, children whose friends just died, and sit down. At the same time, this is a classic culture war thing, right, Eric? Like, let's have a big culture war about guns. What do you say?
Trump loves his culture wars, and Trump also loves to inject himself right into the center of the culture wars, which is what he appears to have done this morning. And this is via Zeke Miller, who is an AP reporter who's covering this morning. There's some sort of event at the White House for governors from all around the country. They're there. And so Zeke Miller updates us on Twitter to tell us that Trump has apparently ripped into the Florida deputies who, as Robbie reported earlier this week or last week, failed to go into the school during the shooting. And Trump, again, via Zeke Miller on Twitter, says, quote, I really believe I'd run in there even if I didn't have a weapon. So there you go. That's going to be the conversation for the rest of the day and maybe the rest of the week. Would the president of the United States, in some hypothetical scenario where he was outside a school that was being shot up, have charged in there
with his bare hands?
With his bare hands.
His huge bare hands.
Maybe would have taken off the head. I don't know what, but it was something. Yeah, he would have charged in there and taken down the shooter on his own. This is classic Trump, right? As you were just saying, Catherine, this is a culture war, and it's also putting himself at the center of the story. My goodness, this man cannot allow anything to happen without injecting himself right to the center of the controversy. And this is actually the second time we've seen this since the school shooting, where he's sort of put himself right in the middle of it. So, I don't know. This is the wrong response from the president of the United States, but this is what'll be all over your Twitter feed the rest of the day.
I'm going to play a clip from Sheriff Israel, who was the supervisor of the deputies who did not go in. Nick, you wrote about some of these comments earlier, as did Robbie. This is from a Jake Tapper interview last week.
Are you really not taking any responsibility for the multiple red flags that were brought to the attention of the Broward Sheriff's Office about this shooter before the incident, whether it was people near him, close to him, calling the police on him?
Jake, I could, Jake, I could only take responsibility for what I knew about. I exercised my due diligence. I've given amazing leadership to this agency.
Amazing leadership?
I've worked... Yes, Jake. There's a lot of things we've done throughout this. This is you don't measure a person's leadership by a deputy not going into a. These deputies received the training they needed.
Maybe you measure somebody's leadership.
Robbie, amazing leadership.
Amazing leadership. Yeah, I mean, this guy has a sort of Trumpian ego. Personality. I've been looking into his leadership and the mistakes the agency made for the last couple of days. They are staggering. It is unbelievable the collective failure of law enforcement that took place here. The Scott Israel, the sheriff, is attempting, and he did so in this interview, to sort of pin all of the blame on the one school resource officer who did not go in, who has been fired. His name is Scott Peterson. But we have heard from other reports that Peterson was not the only one to not go in, that other police officers who work for Broward County, who work for the sheriff's office, also sat idly outside while people were dying. The Coral Springs police, when they arrived, found that those officers had not gone in. Now, I'm not going to say that the sheriff is necessarily personally responsible for them not going in, but he is responsible for the rank incompetence of this office. That they had so many calls, so many tips about the shooter. They had people telling them he is a mass shooter in training. He is going to shoot up a school. They had people telling them that he had guns, that he had put a gun to his brother's head. And this sheriff, I mean, he has a history. We've looked back at him from a couple of years ago. He's a Democrat. He was reelected. He had his elected office that he gave, that he hired sort of his political supporters to do PR, to have these kind of cushy jobs in the sheriff's office. So you can't say to me this doesn't in some sense go all the way to the top. I can't believe he's not more, filled with regret and a little more apologetic for the unbelievable, colossal screw-up that took place under his watch.
Would you describe the screw-up as amazing?
Yeah, the screw-up is amazing, not his leadership.
Well, no, I mean, but this is stunning, and it is such an abdication of responsibility from somebody. It's mind-bending, actually. And also to tie it back to problems with the conservative movement and the Republican Party, this is exactly the type of situation where they cannot make sense of what's going on. And this includes the NRA as well, because the NRA, refuses to ever kind of engage cops until recently, and it's because of Scott Israel they're doing it, but whenever there was a shooting between an unarmed suspect and a cop, the NRA would always be, that suspect deserved it, or they would be silent on it with somebody like Philando Castile, who it was one of the most egregious cases of a lawful gun owner just being shot, almost, executed by a poorly prepared cop who got nervous and shot an innocent man and killed him and got off. This is part of the problem with conservatives, is that they love law enforcement and they never want to criticize cops because cops are so important. And then they say, oh, well, we also want to have gun rights. And then what do you do with something like this? Because what is very quickly happening, and I think ultimately, it's obviously fucked up and it's a total tragedy that this shooting happened. But what is happening is that we're understanding with every passing day that this is fundamentally not about gun control. It's about the failure of police to actually do the jobs that they're paid for. And with the Broward County Sheriff's Office, I mean, this is a guy who in the town hall last week on CNN actually said, even after saying, I can remand anybody into custody to be evaluated psychiatrically whenever I want. He can't actually commit them, but he can force them to be evaluated by a psychiatrist under Florida's what's called their Baker Act. But he said, we need more power. It turns out that his office alone had all the power that they needed in order to either stop or heavily minimize the casualties and the death and the mayhem of this, and they failed. And this is part and parcel of the attack, what is being revealed about police and law enforcement, which is that for all the good they do, there are tons of bad apples and bad actors and whole departments that are next to useless. And it's something that conservatives don't want to touch because they simultaneously want to believe in, you know, certain types of things that are incompatible with one another. And first and foremost is the more power you give the state in order to police immigrants, in order to police infractions or black people and drugs, you end up with people like Scott Israel and all of the other police who shoot innocent people and then get off.
So I'm always hesitant about making the fundamental attribution error, right? Like, I don't want to say something like, it is in the nature of either this particular sheriff or in the nature of people who go into law enforcement generally to want to abuse that power, or, you know, to be more likely to be prone to authoritarian displays. But this guy sure makes it hard to avoid that stereotype. I mean, we have quotes from him from the Sun Sentinel saying about his payola stuff, basically about hiring all these people into his office who have pretty obviously proven to be incompetent. The quote is, what have I done differently than Don Shula or Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King or Gandhi, asked Israel. Men and women who assume leadership roles surround themselves with people who are loyal, who they can depend on, and who they appreciate their skill set. He later also said, lions don't care about the opinions of sheep.
Which is a Tywin Lannister quote from Game of Thrones. Tywin Lannister, the evil, nefarious government bureaucrat who does everything to protect his family instead of looking out for the interests of the realm.
And stood by while lots of people died.
Yes. Yeah.
So, Nick, talk me back into this is a public choice problem, not a problem of character. This is tell me why this is structural and not just like a douchebag invasion.
Yeah, I know. And you know, this, what you're saying, and I agree with you completely, which is that most people in law enforcement are not, you know, they're not droogs from Clockwork Orange who are, you know, they're authoritarian. So they go into law enforcement or anything like that. And the fact of the matter is that there are, you know, all sorts of different police departments that behave differently and responsibly and whatnot. What you have, though, I think here in this particular case, and you can see it, you know, the old adage that the fish rots from the head. If you have somebody like Scott Israel denying that he has responsibility for the performance of his sheriff's office, you know that at every level below him, people are acting the same way. So it's not, oh, it's odd because Scott Israel is such a great guy and such a hard ass and really believes in personal responsibility and workplace responsibility that then there were four of his sheriffs who were sitting around not doing anything. It's like, no, that's all of a piece. And it's the same thing with David Clark, the Milwaukee County Sheriff, who was very popular among all kinds of Republicans until it finally started coming out that, you know, he was doing things that were unspeakable and people were being raped and dying under his care as the head of the Milwaukee County jail system. You know, they finally had to admit, oh, yeah, maybe he is bad, even though we like the way that he talks about how, you know, and essentially, I mean, like, we shouldn't, tap dance around the racial implications. It's great. Sheriff Clark is black. It was great to have a black guy saying, no, you know what, like, drug dealers are mostly black and they, you know, they tend to, you know, get in more violent situations and things like that. And we don't quite care about them in the same way we might if it was affluent white drug users and things like that. You know, and this is the accountability issue that is coming up, and it's hard on police. I remember talking to our former colleague, Radley Balk, who's at the Washington Post, has a great new book out about less about the police and more about expert witnesses and people who do autopsies and other types of expert witnesses as oftentimes fraudulent and out of control. If you have unchecked power, you end up with a lot of bad stuff. This is, you know, Lord Acton 101, that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think along the way, you know, there's a lot of difference between people being responsible in positions of power and being absolutely corrupted. And Israel is not absolutely corrupt. David Clark is probably not absolutely corrupt, but they're somewhere on that spectrum and they're closer to being corrupt and bad at what they do because they don't have the oversight and they don't have public opinion breathing down their neck, and now we do because of social media and other things, than they are to being responsible stewards of, you know, a monopoly on violence that is granted to them by society.
I think Eric, I just have to point out that I love that Don Shula gets top billing in that quote ahead of Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi. I assume
that's also his ranking of preference for those people.
I suppose, yeah. To bring this back around,
by the way, if I could just dilate on that Don Shula thing, you know what? Don Shula hasn't had, you know, he didn't win a Super Bowl for like the last 25 years of his career. So that's like really bad. Shula is now best known as the proprietor of a chain of slowly going bankrupt steakhouses that are not as good as Mike Ditka's.
And maybe that right there is the perfect metaphor for everything that happened in Broward County this week. No, I have no idea what that metaphor is, but I think this gets, you know, just to kind of put a cherry on top of the whole conversation here is that you know, this call for, well, we need more power, we need more authority to fix this problem. When, like, no, the FBI failed here, the Broward County Sheriff's Department failed here, the school failed here, the Florida Department of Child Services or whatever it is, they failed here. They were contacted and warned about Nicholas Cruz as well. The government failures are so deep in this case that the last thing we should be thinking about here is how do we give more power without accountability to the very same bureaucrats and police officers and sheriffs who failed to first of all do something. I'm not entirely sure what it is they could have done. There are certainly things, although it gets a little bit dangerous, I think, to start going down that road of like, oh, well, we wanted to go in and take away his guns before he'd done anything wrong. I don't know how we parse that exactly, but they certainly failed on some level beforehand. They certainly failed while this tragedy was unfolding, and they continue to fail every time Sheriff Israel opens his mouth. He continues to fail in the aftermath here.
So I want to go down that road because I think there's an alternate timeline here. It's a less dark timeline, but it's one in which all of these agencies maximized the use of their power and went in and pulled the kid out of school, took him away from, you know, the home he was in, you know, put him under in some kind of involuntary commitment. You know, the one in which all of the powers that these people already had, which they misused, what happens if they use them to the fullest? I think we're sort of inevitably then on the other side of this equation saying this is a dangerous precedent too, to yank, you know, the pre-crime policing problem.
Sure. But I don't think it would have been pre-crime here in this specific case. Nicholas Cruz had committed violence. He had threatened his brother. He had attacked people. He had said very unequivocally that he was going to commit a school shooting. Certainly there are difficult calls to be made about when can law enforcement, can the authorities actually stop, you know, someone who just has guns and is weird and go in and arrest them. And obviously,
I hope not, because there goes the whole reason
staff. Are going to say no. Yeah. I don't think this was a case of that. I think they certainly, based on that, he did have weapons. He had made threats to shoot up a school, and he was actually perpetrating violence against multiple individuals. That should have been enough. And they knew all that because they were told all that
over and over.
There was certainly enough to go in and arrest him.
I think that, you know, to look more, you know, critically at the libertarian movement, I think that I suppose I'm putting myself in the Marco Rubio position here.
Never put yourself in the Marco Rubio position.
You know, he has nice boots. He has those nice Cuban heel Beetle boots that he used to wear that I think Donald Trump said were very effeminate. But it's, you know, libertarians are not anarchists. And the idea that nobody should ever be questioned about anything. I mean, you know, if the police are receiving legitimate tips about you, you know, they can get a warrant. They can talk to people and things like that. You don't have to talk to them if you don't want to, unless, you know, you are actually, you know, arrested or indicted on something, law enforcement. But, you know, the fact of the matter is libertarians should not be so glib as to say there is either anarchy or there is complete authoritarianism. The whole notion of libertarianism is that we believe in limited government. We're not anarchists. And police have certain types of due process that they need to respect, but there is such a thing as due process. And you know, to kind of follow up on what Robbie's saying, it's not even like there were hints or anything like that. There were particular moments where somebody like Nicholas Cruz actually deserved, you know, much closer scrutiny from authorities, and not simply law enforcement, but also other types of things, because he was living, with his grandparents, I guess, or whatever. I mean, he was in a, in a system for foster care and whatnot, which in Florida in particular is notoriously awful and inefficient. But we need to, I think, get over the idea that there are no actual legitimate government functions or authorities that at times can act in a way, you know, as long as they're following due process and that is respectful of people's basic dignity and rights, that is legitimate.
I, as always, would like to pause here and flag that Nick is wrong about anarchism and will always be wrong about anarchism, but sure. Let's not have that particular fight at this moment, other than to say, I think the Nicholas Cruz case, I basically agree with you guys that it's an easy case in many ways for libertarians to handle because he violated a bunch of laws that were basically just laws. On the other hand, the critique of law enforcement does rest on, you know, in many ways, the delicate line between did they bungle or did they pull back because they are laboring in an environment of ill-defined, but in many cases, overweening powers that they are appropriately hesitant to use. And I think it is a combination, right? I think it's sort of worth saying there are a bunch of ways they could have handled this that we would be up in arms. And to respond to legitimate complaints is important. But the flip side of that is something that we have covered, which is swatting, right? This idea of whatever it is, 4chan or Reddit bros calling in fake threats and in a recent case actually getting someone killed. I guess I just want to devil's advocate but, a little bit I mean, for to, that problem.
No. But to that point, I mean, imagine if one of these people who had called and told the police, and I saw this on Twitter, I don't remember who said this, but I'm stealing it from someone. If the police had been called and said, hey, Nicholas Cruz has a bunch of marijuana at his house, what would the response have been, right? Like, that's, I think, and when I first saw it, I laughed. I was like, oh, yeah, false equivalency. But no, like, there's a legitimate point there. They would have busted down his door with their battering rams and their SWAT teams and gone in then. So, there's something there. That's just, that bothers me on a bunch of libertarian levels, somewhat of an aside from here.
Put the scalpel under the ribs there, Catherine, a bit. If every exercise of state power, including in a situation like this where you think it could have been done legitimately, if every time, say, well, the police should never respond to tips, they should never check out any leads, etc., you know, that's a problem for anarchism to deal with. I don't think it's a problem for libertarianism to deal with. The real problem, and with the swatting story that you talked about,
you have brutalized that straw man, Nick. That straw man is on fire and crushed under the heel of your Cuban boot.
It's funny that straw men never seem to, give a very good fight. It's perennially disappointing that they don't really, have good comebacks. But in the swatting thing, I mean, there are all sorts of problems with that. The really awful thing would be if the person who called in the threat didn't face legal action, and he does, and the police who actually went in and ended up killing somebody didn't face legal action, and they do. And I'm not saying it's okay for cops to kill people as long as they, too, get arrested. But, you know, one of the problems is that they get off scot-free no matter what. And I realize that's a complicated, situation for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, that's where due process and rule of law come into play. And that's what's being unmasked and kind of peeled away from this veneer that we live in a world where the cops are, you know, always good and suspects are always bad. I mean, things have gotten really murky, partly because of social media and partly because people have cell phones and things like that. But it's good. It's more accountability throughout the system.
I want to change gears a little bit and talk about a case which I think is in oral arguments right now. Is that right, Eric? Like pretty much right as we're recording.
Yeah, pretty much as we're speaking right now. I believe
this is a really interesting case that's before the Supreme Court. It's the Janus case in which Mark Janus is a plaintiff who is pushing back on public sector unions. Eric, you wrote a teaser piece this morning, and Nick, you talked to Mark last week. Eric, can you give us a quick sketch of what's going on?
Yeah, that's right. This case deals with that question of public sector unions effectively could really shape the entire future of public sector unionism in this country. Mark Janis is he's a bookkeeper in Michigan, and he has been paying this $50 fee that comes out of every one of his paychecks to the local union of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. That's AFSCME.
I want to interject here and say if Peter were on the podcast, he would note that's a good bottle of booze every pay period.
Exactly.
Continue.
It's as he put it when I was talking to him last week, that it's, you know, it's a vacation, really. I mean, a pretty nice one. He's paid over $6,000 to that union in the course of his 10 plus years of employment in the Michigan Department of Public Records. So he's, you know, raising this issue, and this has worked its way over the last 3 years all the way to the Supreme Court. And basically he's saying, look, I don't want to make this this payment, this fair share fee that I have to pay, even if I'm not a member of the union. And he also says, and it's important to note that he says it's not really about the money. Ultimately, it's about his rights and the rights of other workers who aren't members of the union. He thinks that they should just be allowed to say no. Like, we don't want you to represent us. A union is, of course, a private entity. There are no other private entities in this world, this, you know, government being the public one, that can take money out of your paycheck without you consenting to it. But public sector unions can do this and they do this all the time. And so this case is in front of the Supreme Court. It's really sort of a rehash of a case that was there 2 years ago, Friedrichs v. California. Some of our listeners may be familiar with that one. That appeared as though it was going to be the big public sector union case. There was a lot of buildup to that, just as there has been to this one. After the oral arguments is when former Justice, late Justice Antonin Scalia died. And so that case ended up being a deadlock 4-4. So now Janis, who was sort of the backup, his case had been was in federal court at a lower level when that case was decided, and then he kind of got called up to the big leagues in a way here, and is now his attorneys are in front of the Supreme Court literally as we speak this morning making their oral arguments. This is it's a big case. It really could change literally the entire kind of revenue structure that public sector unions, those very intensely political entities, operate under. And so it has huge ramifications politically, but certainly very important ramifications for the individual workers.
Yeah, if you know, and this is actually what they're relitigating here is a 1977 decision called Abood versus Detroit Department of Education, which back then gave public sector unions the ability to collect this fair share, regardless of whether or not people were members or wanted to be members or even thought they benefited from the collective bargaining agreements that were put into place and workplace representation. And what's interesting about it is, first off, about 28 states, or rather 28 states have ended this in one way or the other. Only 22 states, including Illinois, where Janis is, actually still insist on the right of the public sector union in order to collect this fee. And it almost, if you go back and look at that 1977 decision, almost all of the empirical arguments about why you needed to have mandatory dues paid for the collective bargaining portion of union dues have been shown to be proven false. So, for instance, the idea that the unions wouldn't have enough money in order to actually do what they were doing turns out not to be true, that without public sector unionism, there would be increased work stoppages due to bad working conditions and whatnot. None of that is true. When you add up the arguments that were made in, you know, that decided Abood in one direction and the subsequent change of things, plus, as Eric was pointing out, the fact that Gorsuch has been appointed, things look pretty likely that this will, that Janis will win his case. And so for the 22 remaining states that have this policy, it's, that's going down the tubes.
Just to quickly correct something I said, I think, and Nick got this right, Janis is from Illinois. I think I said he was from Michigan, so that's a mistake on my part. We'll correct that. I think also interesting here, Nick, you mentioned Gorsuch being on the court now. I had a chance last week also to talk to two of the attorneys who are going to be, they are right now, doing the oral arguments in this case. And I asked them, just out of sort of curiosity, whether, because the Friedrichs case was so recent and that was a 4-4 tie and the split on the court here seems pretty clear, like, do you just address all of your points in oral arguments arguments basically to Gorsuch. Is he the obvious swing vote here, maybe even more so than in many other cases where it's easy to identify which justice is the swing vote. And they said no, and they said they think it's actually going to be more difficult. The oral arguments are going to be more complicated this time because the other eight justices have so recently wrestled with this issue and are so well-educated, not that they're not normally well-educated on a case, but that they expect it. And so the attorneys felt that like there may be more hypotheticals posed in this round of oral arguments than is typical for a Supreme Court round of oral arguments. There's always a lot of hypotheticals, of course, but the justices have to weigh, and particularly if they're going to overturn the precedent that was set in that 1977 case that you referenced, Nick, they have to weigh the potential consequences there and try to figure out not only what does this mean for Janus's specific case, but what are they doing? What are they changing about jurisprudence in the United States going forward?
Robbie, there's one thing I wanted to flag for you, which is that the Friedrichs case obviously got preference and made it to the top of the pile first, because framing this in terms of teachers unions brings a lot more to bear in terms of heartstrings. And obviously Friedrichs was a very, great spokesperson. Some dude who's a bookkeeper for the Department of Public Health is a slightly less likely hero. You followed the Friedrichs case at the time. Do you think that there's any element of the teachers union piece of that that might wind up playing out differently this time around? How heavily did that case rely on the "it's for the children" piece?
Yeah, and there was the I guess this is common to both cases, right? The sort of political freedom, the like, why am I obligated to contribute money to a partisan political cause I might not support? How the compelled speech aspect, which is I think kind of really what they were going for in the Friedrichs thing too. I mean, the public school union, teachers unions are also a more obvious kind of villain in a lot of narratives about how politics in America works. They're looking out for the interests of the employees, not of the students. The students and the teachers do not have the same interests, and nor did the union representing the bulk of the teachers have the same interests. So obviously it's exactly like you said. It's Friedrichs was a more appealing sort of heroine for this cause, and teachers unions make for a more interesting villain. But right, the underlying question is still the same. I'd probably actually the thing that I'm most worried about, and maybe this is just my crazy paranoia, is like John Roberts pulling. I don't want to have a major sort of Supreme Court controversial precedent thing on my conscience. He's done this to us before. So, you know, there was no stakes last time because they couldn't prevail after the Scalia departure. So that's what I'd be worried about in this case. But maybe that's just
the
me.
Departure? Can we
departure
say
from this, I mean, mortal veil?
Here, you know, the other thing that's interesting about this case, and it is – I think it would be a good thing for public sector unions to have to actually work in order to get members rather than be able to cost. And, you know, part of the case here, Janus isn't interested in it, but from a technical point of view, the way that unions say that they are, oh, well, this is merely the amount of money that we spend on collective bargaining or representing you when you get called in front of, get called on the carpet for workplace problems. There's a lot of fudge factor that goes into that. So, you know, it's not clear. But the other thing to think about is that still, and particularly with teachers unions in any state, teachers are always the single largest, basically the single largest, public school teachers are the single largest class of employees, and they have massive collective bargaining power because of that. And if you go and look at states that are right to work versus not right to work, places where teacher membership in a union is essentially mandatory, is even just high percentage, it doesn't necessarily map very clearly with what kind of work conditions they have, how much pay they have. So you'll have kind of high union membership states where the pay is relatively low, et cetera. It doesn't really get rid of the political problems with how do you pay state employees so that you're getting good people, but you're not paying too much and you're not giving away too much. It can help, but it's not a panacea to that larger issue of state employees who are, basically being overpaid and underworked or vice versa.
I also wonder about this question with regard to police unions, which, strikes me that we might have to do this again with those, even if, you know, unless the Supreme Court is uncharacteristically sweeping in its ruling, you know, we are, as a country, always willing to carve out extra special exceptions for law enforcement and military.
Really strong point, because, for instance, when Scott Walker did this, when he was governor of Wisconsin, he purposefully excluded police and firefighters from broad edict, whereas John Kasich, as governor of Ohio, did the same thing but included cops and firemen, and the state legislature in Ohio actually repealed it, and I think there was a state constitutional amendment banning essentially the same thing. So it's always, you know, it's always dicey on those scores.
And this general idea of, like, you know, we have to give our officers whatever they need, up to and including defense for shooting people in the face on video forever and ever. Amen. I mean, I think the sort of international equivalent of that is something I think you wrote about this week or last week, Eric. The we have to give our military everything, including we need giant tariffs on steel, because what if we need it to build a tank, including, like, it sort of bleeds out into all these other areas of politics where we've staked out that if it's sort of a dude with a gun and a uniform, he gets infinite consideration. And is only barely bound by the rules that govern the rest of us. I mean, that steel tariff thing, you know, Trump is saying, what is it, 27%?
Yeah, 24%.
24%.
Yeah, we probably don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but this is a big story that is not really getting a lot of attention, is the Trump administration discussing potentially 24% tariffs on all steel imports, period. He was given two options, one that was like a higher tariff on a couple of countries and lower tariffs and quotas on countries where we don't get a lot of steel from, or 24% across the board, and reports are that he's leaning towards that. Go back and look at what happened during the Bush administration. We had some temporary steel tariffs. 200,000 jobs were lost. That's the estimate because of that. Because, of course, if steel is more expensive, anything that you make from steel becomes more expensive, which adds to business costs, which adds to consumer costs on down the line. This is really, it's one of the big things the White House is considering doing in the first half of this year. And it could be really bad for American consumers and manufacturers and a whole bunch of people. But U.S. Steel, believe it or not, they're fully behind this.
They really
want those tariffs. Yeah. Shockingly,
never would have seen
right?
that one coming. Yeah. So I want to end on a slightly more cheerful note, since this has been a deeply depressing Reason podcast all around. We're going to try a new feature at the end of the podcast, in which we recommend to you, our listeners, some stuff that we are consuming. I want to start with Robbie, who, as far as I can tell, is always playing a video game while doing something else. I don't know if his answer will be a video game, but he seems to be the master of multitasking. Robbie, give us your first contribution to the Have You Seen segment.
Not a video game. I'm also always watching television, often rewatching old television, but my new show right now, not my new show, but it's back on, is Homeland, which recently came back for its seventh season, I believe. It's had a sort of rocky stretch for a while, but is very interesting right now because it's mapped onto current U.S. politics in an actually a good way. The president survived a deep state coup and has now gone full authoritarian to purge all the government officials that conspired to kill her. And in opposition to her is this sort of alt-righty Alex Jones type person who's totally a con artist, but is right that she's a power mad authoritarian. And also she's right that there was a deep state coup against her. So it's interesting. Like, everybody's kind of right and wrong and crazy at the same time.
Eric, I think I can guess your answer to what you've been consuming the last few days. Can you talk to us about something exciting in your world?
I've been consuming a lot of the Winter Olympics, and I know Nick is going to get mad at me at this because he's a classic Olympics hater, and I am too on some levels. But I love the Winter Olympics. So that's pretty much all I've been watching for the last 2 weeks, including, we got to give a big shout out to the U.S. curling team, the U.S. men's curling team, bringing home the most unexpected gold medal in U.S. team sports since the 1980 men's hockey team and the Miracle on Ice. I say that in full sincerity. This team had finished near the bottom of the standings in the last three Olympics, was a one loss away from elimination last Monday, facing Canada, who they had never beaten. The United States had never beaten Canada in the history of the Winter Olympics in curling. They beat Canada to keep themselves alive, went on to beat Switzerland and Great Britain to narrowly squeak into the medal rounds, where they had to face Canada again, beat them a second time, and then incredibly took down Sweden for the gold medal on early Saturday morning. Really just an incredible run of games by a really terrific team, and a guy, John Schuster, whose personal story is really just fascinating, a guy who was sort of cast out by USA Curling after his failures at the last two Olympics, was not invited to participate in some of their high-level training programs, went out, formed his own team. The vice skip on his team, his second-in-command, had retired from competitive curling and was running a liquor store in Duluth, Minnesota.
This is basically
dodgeball for curling. Is the movie?
Yeah, and Schuster lost 35 pounds in order to
Schuster
come back.
Schuster lost 35
everything.
Pounds. Yeah. He got in better shape, and he's always been a really good curler. He's always been maybe the best curler in the country, but he's never been able to come through in the big moment. And with his back against the wall, his whole team's backs against the wall at the Olympics, they delivered seriously a gold medal.
Eric,
that
you
I will
just
never
did the
forget.
Impossible. You made curling sound interesting to me.
It is
hates all sports and curling.
I'm going to extend this just for one more minute to mention two other Olympians that stood out to me in my watching of the Olympics the last 2 weeks. Esther Ledecka is a downhill snowboarder who was set to become the first woman in Olympic history, the first person, I believe, in Olympic history to ever compete in both snowboarding and skiing events at the same games. So just by making it down the mountain in the Super G downhill skiing race, she was going to go into the record books anyway. She was seated way down in the field, 29th, I think, out of 40 competitors. She won the gold medal. She just sort of accidentally won. Got to the bottom of the hill. Her reaction, go look it up, it's online, is absolutely priceless. She stands at the bottom of the hill, looks up at the big board where they have all the times displayed, and goes, no. She just, like, her mouth goes open, and the first thing she says is, no, no. And, like, the cameraman comes over, and you can hear the cameraman on one of the audio feeds say, you just won, you just won. And she looks right into the camera and goes, no. And it's just an absolutely priceless moment of somebody who, you know, had no expectation of winning but managed to knock off some of the top competitors in the world. And then my man, Martin Foucault of France, the world's best biathlete, absolutely stunning in a couple of his races. So, yeah, I'm a full-on Olympics nerd, I'll admit.
I definitely want to see the movie of the curling story. Am I wrong, Eric, to think that the Olympians in these games, everybody lived like super perfectly up to the stereotype of their sport? Like the gal who surprisingly won, like at the end, like just that seems appropriate for that sport somehow to have somebody that accidentally wins in that moment. I don't know. And then we got the curler who's the liquor store guy. Yep.
You got to throw in Sean White also winning gold,
exactly,
which was like the flying tomato making a kind of dramatic exit from the sport, I assume, which was pretty fantastic as well, while
coming
also kind of ushering in the next generation of great snowboarders.
Yeah, it was the young kid, the 17-year-old or 18-year-old kid who won one of the other snowboarding gold medals for the United States.
And accidentally said fuck on TV.
Yeah, accidentally said fuck on TV.
And was like, oh, I overslept.
Showed
like,
up in somebody else's coat to compete because he lost his coat.
This is what I'm talking about.
Like,
it seems like
amazing.
Everyone leaned into their caricature.
Very much so.
Snowboarding
so this was a very
is
fun
the
Olympics,
best, yeah. I think, sport for that because it was born the first gold medalist. I guess it was in, I can't remember now if it was at Salt Lake City or in Calgary when it was introduced, but he tested positive for marijuana. He was a Canadian. And then they stripped him of his gold medal. And then he said, how can you do that? It's not on the list of banned surfaces, substances. And you're saying pot is a performance enhancing drug for snowboarding. You got to be crazy. And they had to give him the gold medal back. And now he's like a leading cannabis guy.
This is the future libertarians want. Mm-hmm. Eric, I want to just get on the record here. One reason you're so excited about curling is because you yourself are a curler.
Yeah, I will freely admit that. I am a curler. I will be up at the Potomac Curling Club in Laurel, Maryland tonight, actually, if anybody listening wants to come by and check it out.
And throw sand
a great sport.
On your pitch or whatever. What do they call the court?
I'm not getting paid to say that. No, it really is. It's a terrific sport. It's a terrific sport to play recreationally. It's honestly far from the most interesting sport to watch, and I watch a lot of sports. I probably watch as much sports as Robbie plays video games. It's not a very entertaining sport on TV, but the gold medal game between the U.S. and Sweden was a really great curling match.
I think
in terms
you're
of
wrong,
the competitive
though.
Strategy of it, yeah.
You're come on, it's a great game to watch, even if you don't, as my I can myself in this, you don't really know what's going on, but it's like a super intense high tech version with a lot of sweeping of shuffleboard or bocce or something, and the overhead shot so
that
you see the targets.
That did not sell it, Nick.
Oh, no. It's I started watching curling, I think it was like two or three Winter Olympics ago, because it's so bizarre and everybody is intense, but really kind of quiet. And it's and then the Americans this time around, they really did look like the guys who work at your corner liquor store or something. You could see them carrying all of their stuff in like a paper bag like you would take out of a liquor store.
Yeah, they're a very easy team to root for, especially against the Canadians, who like the guy who's the skip of the Canadian team looks like a young John Locke from Lost. He just has like a really
creepy.
Oh, now
I'm paying attention again.
Yeah, he has a really creepy just woke up. Sort of look to him, and he looks. I mean, he's a stereotypical villain. When they cast the movie, I'm telling you, this is a movie. It's right there. It's all right there.
So speaking of which, my contribution to the reason recommendation engine here is I started reading the King Killer Chronicles, which are a series of books by Patrick Rothfuss. I started reading them because I saw a little note saying that Lin-Manuel Miranda has picked up the rights to this series. He's going to executive produce a Showtime series based on these books. For those of you who might be interested in that confluence of proper nouns, I will give you a few more. The books are basically, if Neil Gaiman was playing Dungeons and Dragons and the Dungeon Master had just been watching a lot of Walking Dead, that's kind of the vibe of this series.
I'll watch it.
I strongly recommend the books. I cannot yet speak to what the impresario of Hamilton will do for the King Killer Chronicles, but I am hopeful. Nick, take us home with your recommendation.
Well, first, I want to drag this out by asking, are more junior millennials on this call, Eric and Robbie, are you guys post-literary? Like, do you not read? Do you only watch?
I read.
For pleasure.
Reading? What is reading? Is that yeah. That's what you olds do?
You look at the page yes. and these yeah, little squiggles right. make you hallucinate. I
use a Kindle. I don't know the last time I picked up a paper book, but
I've been reading the forums for my games yeah. during this Olympic recap for the last 20
And Robbie,
minutes,
so. Do you want to come clean and talk about your undying love for Zelda?
Yeah, that's my forum avatar, man. I've beaten basically everything there is to beat in the Nintendo Switch Breath of the Wild game. So yeah. I've kind of retired that game for now.
So my over the weekend, I was turned on to Toast of London, which is a great British show that has three seasons on Netflix and a fourth one coming sometime in 2018, supposedly. But it's about a really shitty, arrogant, idiotic British actor named Stephen Toast, who's in The World's Worst Play and then also doing voice work. It's an incredibly funny show. And if you like shows like The Inbetweeners or The IT Crowd, you will absolutely find the show hilarious. It's also got a taste of Flight of the Conchords in it. Very funny, very British, very dirty, or very adult, not very dirty. And then I'm also reading Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III, who was the creator, the maker of the best LSD that the country has ever seen in the 60s, also was a roadie and sound tech for the Grateful Dead, and is credited with, among other things, doing the Dancing Bears, which are actually marching bears, as well as the kind of steal your face insignia of the skull icon with the lightning bolt through it. And I'm also, it's by Robert Greenfield, who wrote an incredibly hate-filled biography of Timothy Leary a few years ago that is also worth reading. And I'm reading Sam Rosenfield's The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era, which is very much in the Morris Fiorina camp of saying that we are not so polarized in America, but our politics are, because the political process rewards that. And John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, said we may be coming to the end of a two-party system because Republicans, to bring it back to Mona Charon and CPAC, he's like, he doesn't recognize the Republican Party anymore. So Rosenfield and Morris Fiorina and a few other people who talk about this type of stuff are probably on the forefront of something.
Nick, I understand you must have experienced some anxiety about not getting enough boomer references in this podcast because you just like slammed us with all of them at the end there. I appreciate that.
LSD is more popular now than it was among baby boomers, I think. So, it's really about staying forever young, which is, of course, also a boomer reference.
LSD clearly accounts for what just happened on this Reason podcast. Thank you for joining us. I have been Catherine Mengu Ward with Robbie Suave, Eric Baim, and Nicholas Gillespie, who is a boomer. Thank you very much. If you liked what you heard or if you didn't, please go on iTunes, rate, review, subscribe, show us some love, show us some hate. Thanks.